Today is Thursday, July 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as the novel coronavirus continues to spread, experts warn that even those who recover can feel its impacts linger.
We live in a society, we go to the gym, we're trying to stay fit, we're trying to make healthy choices. This is one healthy choice we can make. Avoid getting COVID-19.
Despite lawsuits and questions of legality, the president orders more federal agents to U.S. cities.
They arrested someone without probable cause. That's unconstitutional. It's illegal.
Also ahead, an Irish indie band that says it's okay with sharing a name with the pandemic. It's all on today's International Edition. The novel coronavirus has now killed more than 617,000 people around the world as the United States inches closer to 4 million infections and almost 143,000 people dead. Data released from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the actual number of coronavirus infections in some parts of the country is anywhere between 2 to 13 times higher than what has been officially reported. But a day after President Donald Trump said the pandemic will get worse before it gets better, he seemed to steer back to his previous rosy picture of the U.S. outbreak Wednesday.
We will get to the other end of that tunnel very quickly, we hope. The light is starting to shine. We will get there very quickly.
California Wednesday overtook New York, the original epicenter of the nation's outbreak, as the worst-hit state, with the number of cases climbing above 414,000. Meanwhile, the head of emergencies at the World Health Organization said Wednesday it is becoming apparent that many people who develop moderate illness from COVID-19 face long-term issues like fatigue, including otherwise healthy young people who may take months to fully recover.
It takes a long time for your lungs to regain their normal function, and sometimes for your cardiovascular system. And that's why a lot of people are suffering long-term fatigue. They're finding it really hard to go back to the gym. They're exhausted if they're going up and down the stairs. And these are young people.
Dr. Michael Ryan said the virus can lead to an inflammatory process in air sacs and small blood vessels, and as a result, can take a long time for lung and heart functions to get back to normal. As dozens of companies around the world move aggressively to create a COVID-19 vaccine, the Trump administration said Wednesday it will pay Pfizer nearly $2 billion for a December delivery of 100 million doses of a vaccine the pharmaceutical company is developing. Pfizer Senior Vice President John Burkhardt on the very early stages of their findings.
The first clinical trials have been a single dose. 3 weeks later, patient comes back and gets a second dose. And the data that we have so far illustrate a really robust host immune response to that.
Under the initiative, the government will speed development and buy vaccines before final testing is complete. The U.S. could buy another 500 million doses under the agreement if the vaccine ultimately proves safe and effective. Some medical experts have expressed concern over a rush to secure a vaccine before it is fully vetted. Face coverings are now compulsory in the lockdown Australian city of Melbourne as the COVID-19 crisis intensifies in that specific part of the country. Residents can only leave their homes for work, study, exercise, and other essential business. Australia has had 12,400 confirmed coronavirus infections and 126 deaths. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
The face covering order is the first of its kind in Australia, which has recorded more than 500 new cases of COVID-19 in the past 24 hours. It's the single biggest daily increase since the pandemic began. Most have been detected in the southeastern state of Victoria. Outbreaks have been reported at more than 40 nursing homes, and several prisons have been put into lockdown. Bandanas, scarves, and handkerchiefs are all acceptable, as the people of Melbourne are ordered to cover their faces outdoors. Residents are being given official advice on how to make their own masks from clothes and shopping bags. Associate Professor Philip Russo is from Monash University.
It's not an exact science because we're still learning about this every day. We know that it's transmitted through close contact, so physical distancing is our first action in our prevention. And when physical distancing can't be maintained, then that's when masks can come into consideration.
As the crisis continues, travel between Victoria State and other parts of Australia is being heavily restricted and more stringent border controls put in place. About 2,400 new COVID-19 cases have been reported in the past week across Australia. It is a significant number. Since the pandemic began, almost 12,500 infections have been diagnosed. The spike in cases is undermining Australia's previous successes in tackling the virus. This week, a judicial inquiry began into how infected travellers returning to Australia from overseas could have spread the disease while in mandatory quarantine in Victoria. The hearing was told that many recent infections in the state could be linked to breaches in hotel security. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Attorneys for the state of Oregon argued Wednesday for a restraining order against federal agents deployed to quell Black Lives Matter protests in Portland, a standoff that some legal experts warn could lead to a constitutional crisis. Oregon's attorney general accuses the agents of arresting protesters without probable cause, whisking them away in unmarked cars and using excessive force, allegations federal officials dispute. Amid intense scrutiny of the incident and likening the arrest to a kidnapping by secret police, Trump administration officials have tried to explain what happened. Department of Homeland Security Acting Secretary Chad Wolf defended what he termed as proactive arrests.
We are expressly allowed to leave federal property to conduct investigations and arrest individuals who have damaged federal property.
VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to Andrew Crespo, professor of criminal law and criminal procedure at Harvard Law School in Massachusetts, about whether these arrests are legal.
An arrest under the Constitution, at a minimum, and this is clear under our Supreme Court law going back at least till 1979, happens when the police take somebody off of the street, put them in a car and drive them to a station house or some other government building to question them. That is an arrest. And that's why this is so important, because if they do that to you and then decide to kind of let you out the back door of the station and never really even record it necessarily internally, never charge you, never book you, never take fingerprints, they might not call that an arrest because they might not be counting. Well, how many people did you just maybe put in the back of a van, take into the station house, keep there for 20 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, and then just let go? They might not be calling that an arrest, but under our Constitution, that's an arrest. And if they don't have probable cause for it, it is illegal.
So the acting Department of Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf tried to justify this by saying it is a, quote, proactive arrest. What does that mean? Is that a real legal justification?
The term proactive arrest or proactive policing sort of gives you this image, trying to stop crime before it happens sort of thing, arrest people who haven't done anything because you think they're going to. That's the image the phrase proactive policing brings to mind. I actually don't think that is what Secretary Wolf was talking about, because inside the law enforcement community here, the word proactive policing or proactive arrest doesn't mean arresting people who haven't done anything because you think they will. Rather, it means something else that could still be criticized as problematic, but under our law is legal. And what that is arresting people on what you might call a technicality or a more minor offense because you think that they are going to do something more serious or because you think that they're kind of generally problematic.
So it's like you suspect someone is a drug dealer, but you don't have proof, so you pull them over for speeding or something like that.
Exactly. That's called pretextual policing, and it sometimes falls in with this phrase proactive policing. My guess is that that's what Secretary Wolf had in mind when he was talking about proactive policing. The bigger issue with the press conference is when Deputy Director Klein, who's basically in charge of this sort of beefed up federal presence that now includes not just his own officers, but a bunch of officers from our Border Patrol agency that have been sort of assigned to him, when he says on national TV that taking someone off the street, putting them in a van and driving them away for questioning, when he says, oh, well, that was, quote, not a custodial arrest, that's really problematic, more problematic than the proactive policing phrase, because Director Klein is just wrong. If you take someone off the street, put them in a van, and drive them in for questioning. You have arrested them, and it requires that you have probable cause. Director Klein stood up and said, we didn't have probable cause to take that man off the street who you've all seen in this video.
So based on what you're saying here, it sounds like this arrest or these arrests by these federal paramilitaries in Portland are unconstitutional. They're illegal.
I'm saying that at a minimum, this viral video that at least here millions of people have seen of these two agents dressed in full fatigues going up to a man who has his hands up and taking him off in a van, that is clearly an unconstitutional arrest. Because Director Klein is admitting that the agents did not have probable cause to do what they did. He thinks they didn't arrest the person. It's absolutely clear they did arrest him. And he's the one saying they didn't have probable cause. You put those two things together, they arrested someone without probable cause. That's unconstitutional. It's illegal.
So what can be done about this?
Civil lawsuits, civil rights lawsuits. You can go into court and say to the judge, I'm the plaintiff here. I'm coming in and I'm trying to tell you, judge, I want you to issue an order to the Department of Homeland Security that tells them to stop making all of these unlawful arrests. If it just happened once or twice, then the courts say, well, I'm not going to order the whole department to change its practices because you haven't shown me that it's a departmental problem. But we're getting increasingly, you know, more information that suggests this actually is a systematic problem. And I don't think that there's really anything more powerful to show that than the fact that the director of the agency stands up on national television and just demonstrates to the world that he doesn't know what an arrest is. If he doesn't know what an arrest is, then he doesn't know whether or not his agents are arresting people lawfully or unlawfully. And that suggests a broader problem. If there's a broader problem, the courts have the ability to step in.
Andrew Crespo, professor of criminal law and criminal procedure at Harvard Law School in Massachusetts, speaking to VOA's Jason Patinkin. President Trump said Wednesday he plans to deploy more agents to Chicago and Albuquerque, New Mexico, to fight rising crime. A report by the UK National Cybersecurity Center this month accused hackers with links to Russian intelligence of attacking organizations developing a vaccine for COVID-19. The report has raised diplomatic tensions and opened a window into the world of pharmaceutical intelligence. VOA's Tatiana Vorosko has the story, narrated by Anna Rias.
The report by the UK National Cybersecurity Center says Russian hackers have been using spear phishing and malware to target British, Canadian, and US organizations researching COVID-19 vaccines. The center says the hacking group APT29, also known as the Dukes and Cozy Bear, attacked the companies in a bid to steal information about COVID-19 vaccine development and testing. Experts say the group is also linked to Russian intelligence services.
This group in particular has been known for doing covert, so quiet, secret espionage. And the most high-profile targets that we've seen APT29 go after, State Department, the White House, the DNC in 2015 before the 2016 breach by a different group. So this is the go-to group. This is the most specialized group for high-value intelligence.
Russia rejects the accusations.
We don't accept these allegations. We don't know who tried to hack what in the UK. It's certain that Russia has nothing to do with it.
Security experts say the hacking attempt suggests that under Vladimir Putin, Russia has not invested in the kind of science and research needed to develop its own vaccine.
Russian science is behind not just the U.S. and U.K. and Europe. It's behind China. It's behind India. And Putin desperately wants to build that up. But he spent the first half of his reign developing an oligarchy, right? Developing oil and gas and not putting money into the universities or into the public school system to develop the kind of talent pool that you need to do that high-level science.
The alleged hacking attempts are consistent with how Moscow conducts its foreign policy, said Brian Whitmore, director of the Russian program at the Center for European Policy Analysis.
Everything from the doping scandals to the violations of Ukraine's sovereignty to the use of chemical weapons on the territory of the United Kingdom. So the fact that Russia would do something like this should not surprise us at all.
Russia isn't the only nation to conduct this kind of cyber espionage. Recently, several top Republican lawmakers called on Trump to impose sanctions on China for stealing COVID-19 research and other information.
The barriers to conducting this type of activity are just very low, and the risks are relatively low. Cyber espionage around the globe is picking up. It is a method that allows countries a certain level of deniability. It also helps them avoid actions that could result in more aggressive responses from the United States and its partners.
According to the center's report, so far it appears the hacking group has not stolen valuable intelligence or interfered with research to develop the vaccine. For Tatiana Voroshko in Fairfax, Virginia, NRI's VOA News.
Almost 4 million people have been hit by monsoon floods in South Asia, with a third of Bangladesh already underwater from some of the heaviest rains and flooding in a decade. It's taking an especially tough toll on Rohingya refugee families at Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh, who are already having to contend with the COVID-19 pandemic. Joining us, Bangladesh, Shairoz Malji, Acting Field Office Chief for UNICEF at Cox's Bazar. Thank you for being with us. It sounds like this is a really intense monsoon season, and I imagine it's having an especially harsh impact on refugees already coping with so much. What's the situation there on the ground?
Floods in the northern part of the country have hit really badly. Here in Cox's Bazar, we're not witnessing the floods as badly as in the rest of the country. However, with the intense downpours over the last few weeks, which has led to localized flooding, landslides, the shelters which the refugees live in have been damaged. Just last week, we had over 9,000 refugees who were affected by the storms and landslides. And in total, 130 shelters were fully destroyed, displacing 500 people. The refugee shelters are made of bamboo and plastic sheeting, so they're very susceptible to adverse weather.
What are you all doing to help people cope, and how are they being impacted by all of this, especially the children, of course?
With COVID-19, in addition to the monsoon floods, and here I'll speak specifically of Cox's Bazar, the current situation for children is, of course, very difficult. Already with COVID-19, the children who have shown incredible resilience since they arrived, but now with the education programs closed, a lot of the protection, child protection programs and facilities closed, the humanitarian footprint has reduced considerably. The children are affected, and so there are fewer things for children to do. There are more incidents of child marriage, child labor, exploitation, and abuse. And what we and other organizations are doing in terms of both COVID-19 and flood response are offering critical services. So we have reduced the number of staff who go to the camps, but we have ensured that health facilities, critical services like food that is distributed, repair of the shelters as soon as possible, the homes that they live in, is done. And so we are still focusing on health, expanding the hygiene promotion, that's hand washing with soap, and, you know, critical information for families and children so that they know where to go, whether it's regards to the monsoon and what are some of the things they can do to prevent the diarrheal diseases, or for COVID-19 as well. For COVID-19, we have the added message about wearing masks as well, which is one of the preventative measures that is being put into place in the whole country as well.
How big of a problem is COVID-19 within the camps?
So currently, the situation for COVID-19, we have 62 positive cases and 6 deaths in the camps. This is actually lower than what we had expected, and that's probably because the true picture, because the testing coverage is very low, the refugees have been reluctant to come forward for testing because they fear being isolated from their families if they test positive. So looking at the country picture where we do have community transmission of COVID-19, we fear that the situation will start to increase also in the camps. And therefore, we are focusing on the awareness raising components and the campaign, as well as to address the refugees' fears and misperceptions around COVID-19.
Their situation without any of these other additional problems would be difficult, just being refugees and having to leave their home, you know, the added burden of a monsoon and, of course, this pandemic. How are kids doing emotionally?
Children are resilient. However, what we're starting to see is that they are starting to become more despondent. The children who, you know, used to go to a learning center or classroom, used to be able to play outside, gather with their friends, are having to stay home more often. Some of them are experiencing abuse, as I mentioned, protection issues like child marriage, like child labor. More of them are working. We're starting to see also that some of them have very little stimulation structure in their lives. They're confined in, you know, small spaces. Even when they go outside, that their interactions are limited. And with having monsoon rains, with being told that they need to stay closer to home or in their home, they are struggling. And the children look forward to having a routine again. And especially they mentioned going back to school, back to education, back to learning, and being able to meet their friends and be able to play with them.
What is the plan going forward for UNICEF's work there with these children as far as trying to help get through all of this and find some normalcy?
UNICEF is working in different areas in the camps. One is with health facilities so that we offer immunization so that children can get vaccinated. They are offered vitamin A supplementation. We have learning centers. So we're now looking and planning with other partners, other humanitarian actors, and with the government so that together we can start to find ways to offer education, learning, whether it be in smaller sessions, whether we look at alternative ways, offering adolescents an opportunity to meet in smaller groups, provide psychosocial support to the children and the adolescents, water sanitation, give them messages on hygiene promotion to support the children and their families in the Rohingya refugee camps.
Shairoz Malji, UNICEF Acting Field Office Chief at Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh. Israel's only two Arab peace partners, Jordan and Egypt, are making what analysts say are public shows of support against any Israeli unilateral move toward annexation of West Bank land. Dale Gavlak reports from Amman.
The recent visit by the Egyptian foreign minister to the Palestinian town of Ramallah is a blow to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's narrative that Israel's Arab partners are indifferent toward annexation. International Crisis Group senior analyst Ofar Salzberg told Arab News, a Saudi daily. Jordan's top diplomat, meanwhile, reiterated his country's long-standing position that there is no alternative to the two-state solution toward resolving the Israeli-Palestinian crisis during Tuesday's talks with the UN Special Coordinator for Middle East Peace. Jordanian analyst Osama Al-Sharif says Mr. Netanyahu has backed off from declaring annexation over the West Bank lands at this time because his coalition partner Benny Gantz has not given his approval. Also, Al-Sharif says Washington wants the Trump peace deal to be taken as a whole, including the establishment of a Palestinian state.
So this is where the U.S. administration stands now, and Netanyahu would not risk taking a unilateral step if he does not get the green light from the Trump administration. Definitely the timing is off for Netanyahu to make such a controversial deal at this time. That does not mean that he will not do something or that the U.S. administration will not eventually give him the green light, but this is where we stand today.
Nabil Shath, senior advisor to the Palestinian president, told the Carnegie Middle East Center webinar that he did not think the current Israeli government wanted either a one-state or two-state solution.
One-state solution, a one-state that is democratic, secular, multinational, has Jews, Christians, and Muslims in one democratic state. And that is a solution that I personally was highly involved in doing. In 1968-69, I was able to get full approval from the Palestinian National Council to make this our objective. But that didn't work. The Israelis don't want that. They want a Zionist state. They don't want a democratic state for all the population. So then we went to the two-state solution on the basis of the borders of 1967. And that, too, did not work out.
Shath and other Arab negotiators say they would like to see the international community as a whole take a more active and leading role in trying to resolve the decades-old conflict. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
In what appears to be a dramatic deterioration in relations between the world's two largest economies, the United States has given China 72 hours to close its consulate in Houston, Texas, amid accusations of spying. The U.S. State Department said Wednesday the Chinese mission in Houston was being closed to, quote, protect American intellectual property and Americans' private information. VOA's International Edition continues. Global tourism revenues are expected to fall by as much as $3 trillion due to COVID-19 restrictions, according to a UN study published this month. When the coronavirus outbreak hit Japan, a tourism startup built by an Indonesian man in Tokyo was also hit hard. David John lost his main income in the blink of an eye. But as VOA's Vina Mubtadi reports, he was able to get up with a little bit of magic.
Not every day is magical unless you're David John. From his house in Tokyo, he performs magic tricks to people of all ages around the world.
You know, I can perform for someone in Lebanon at 10 a.m. and 2 hours later, I suddenly have to visit some homes in Paraguay. 3 hours later, I'm going to visit some family in London. So you basically go global.
And at the end of the one-hour session, he teaches his viewers a simple magic trick or two.
Virtual, tapi...
Although it's virtual, it's very interactive. It's very interesting because it feels as if you are watching it live.
The thought of being a full-time virtual magician never occurred to John, a former IT professional who started a tourism business 3 years ago. For the past 12 years, pulling objects seemingly from thin air was mostly a hobby. The 43-year-old used to arrange and lead tours exploring Japan and did magic only on the side. But everything changed when the COVID-19 outbreak hit the Asian country.
All the tours were canceled. Basically overnight, no more. You don't see anything is gonna come back maybe in the next few months. But and the more you wait, the more you realize, no, it's not coming back this year.
In April, he promoted himself on Airbnb and since then has performed more than 100 shows virtually. Most of the clients are in the United States. For some people, the online magic experience is a welcome escape in a time of uncertainty.
I'm staying at home still, and I'm in a big house by myself, and it's a way to connect with people and not feel so alone.
Abracadabra. But along with increasing popularity of virtual shows, John also faced increased competition. So John, who's been living more than 20 years in Japan, tried to be different by incorporating Japanese themes and cultures.
Tourism, my other interest, I can try to combine that just to make myself unique. So when people come to my profile, they say, okay, I'm not going to see just magic. I'm going to find out something else from this guy.
For now, John brings Japanese tourism to his magic shows. But he also hopes to be able to bring back magic to his tourism business and entertain visitors. One day, when Japan is fully back in business after recovering from the pandemic. In Silver Spring, Maryland, Vina Mubtadi, VOA News.
Irish indie music band The Coronas released their sixth album this month. As VOA's David Byrd reports, the band says it has no plans to change its name even during the worldwide pandemic.
I didn't hear, I suddenly know, the way you walked away really messed me up.
With a name like The Coronas, releasing an album during a pandemic caused by a coronavirus that has killed hundreds of thousands worldwide might seem like a bad idea. Lead singer Danny O'Reilly said the band did not want to make light of the situation and had even tweeted to the Corona beer brewers for advice. They didn't respond. But O'Reilly told the Associated Press he felt the band had to address what he called the elephant in the room.
We're only making fun of our name. We're not making fun of the virus. So, you know, I think it would have been weirder if we said nothing about it. So we started putting out some tweets and all about being called the worst band in the world and whatever it is, you know. So, yeah, it's one of those things.
The band existed long before the pandemic. Its name came from the movie Almost Famous, which came out just as the Coronas was forming. The movie featured a typewriter called a Corona Smith Deluxe. O'Reilly says the pandemic hasn't seemed to affect the band's popularity, and he thinks that's because they're making good music.
You know, I've been told that our Spotify numbers are up But I'm trying to say that's because we're releasing good music. That's nothing to do with our name. So it's a tough one, but who knows? I mean, I think anyone who actually likes the band, you know, I put myself, like, you know, if the virus was called the Beatles, it wouldn't make me like the Beatles any less. So I don't think it's going to have a huge impact in that way. You know?
Like many artists, the Coronas have had to cancel performances because of lockdown restrictions and venue closures.
You've been listening to International Edition. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Bunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. We thank you so much for listening. Have a great day.